know that you have been walking through the Gospel of Mark, and one of my concerns as I was thinking about this was not repeating things that perhaps have already been said. I know you've been involved in a great study as you are now in your second semester of walking through the Gospel of Mark. Even though we're going to be in Mark 15, I wanted to start this morning by backtracking just a few chapters to Mark chapter 10. It's interesting to me that in Mark, in particular, there are three occasions, and you can see the three references there, Mark 8, 31, Mark 9, 30, and 31, and then finally the passage in front of you, Mark 10, 33, and 34, where Jesus anticipates his suffering. And what's interesting is not only the way that on three occasions Jesus prepared his disciples for this, but how with each occasion he gets more specific with regard to the suffering he was going to experience. In Mark 8, verse 31, we're told he began to teach his disciples that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And you'll see that on all three of these occasions, Jesus references those specific aspects of his suffering. Then in Mark 9, 30 and 31, especially verse 31, we read, he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he's been killed, he'll rise 3 days later. So two rather generic references to what would happen in just a short time on that Friday afternoon in Jerusalem. So the last of those occasions is in Mark 10. And the reason I find this to be so important when we go to Mark 15 is what Jesus talks about here is literally fulfilled in the passage we're going to be looking at in a few minutes together. So let's read this. Jesus again is speaking to his disciples, and this occasion is far more specific than he has been on the first two occasions. And he says, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes. So he specifies who he'll be delivered to. And they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again. And when you look at the context of the passage we are looking at this morning, very specifically, each of these is fulfilled. Now, we're not looking at Mark 14 this morning, but if you back up to verse 65 of Mark 14, sure enough, no surprise, what Jesus anticipated happening happened. We're told that he was delivered over to the Sanhedrin. They have accused him of blasphemy, and he is abused there. They blindfold him, they slap him, they mockingly ask him to tell him who hit him. That's what you do when you're making fun of somebody. The Gentiles are also going to make fun of him, but it's not because they believe he's a prophet. They make fun of him because they hear that he's claimed to be a king. And we've got to remember that these soldiers that are interacting with Jesus in our passage this morning aren't really concerned about what he claimed. They probably know very little about what the Jews believe and could care less. It's their job to carry out punishment and perhaps even execution, although there's a more specific squadron of soldiers under the leadership of a centurion who would be responsible for his actual execution. So on this occasion, you see everything Jesus has talked about previously coming to pass. And so if you've got a Bible in front of you, let's go to Mark 15. We're going to start reading in verse 16, and we'll read down through verse 21. And this is the block of material that we're going to try to limit our focus to this morning. So we're told in Mark 15, starting in verse 16, the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is, the praetorium, and they called together the whole Roman cohort. They dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him, and they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They kept beating his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and kneeling and bowing before him. And they had mocked him. After they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off him, and put his own garments on him, and they led him out to crucify him. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And so what I'd like for us to do is just obviously back up to verse 16 and spend some time thinking about exactly what's said here. And one of the advantages we have is that we're all very familiar with, of course, this scene, this story. It's central to our faith as Christians. One of the disadvantages, however, is that we're so familiar with this story, we might not think about the way that Mark tells this story or some of the details that we might have overlooked or not thought about a whole lot. So it's been a real joy to prepare this lesson afresh this week, and I hope that as we walk through it, you'll feel free to make comments or observations or ask questions. The sermon's coming later today, so this can be interactive, and I don't always take a breath and ask for that, but feel free to throw out any comments or observations you have as we walk through this. Before we look specifically at verse 16, I would be remiss to not mention that Mark seems to tell this story without a lot of flowery language. He doesn't provide a lot of detail. It's just almost a matter-of-fact telling of the story. I think that when we read it, perhaps, you know, there's a lot of movies that try to portray this, and sometimes, of course, in the way that this is portrayed, there's a lot of emphasis on the physical suffering of Jesus, and that's, of course, appropriate because we know that the physical suffering of Jesus on this occasion was terrible. But what I find interesting is Mark says very little about the physical suffering of Jesus, at least in this passage. He seems to be focused more on what people were trying to do to Jesus. And if there's a word that I think, at least, that Mark's keying on here more than physical suffering, it's shame. It's the attempt of the Sanhedrin in chapter 14 and these soldiers in chapter 15 to shame Jesus, to mock Jesus, to ridicule everything they've heard about him. And it's not because they believe he's a false prophet. They don't care about prophecy. It's because they've been given the task of carrying out a sentence, knowing that this man's going to die, and that, ironically, they believe someone who's claimed great power and kingship is now a pawn. He's now in the seat of Roman power. And it seems, at least, that there's nothing he can do to stop it. And so looking at this from a worldly perspective, Mark seems to not focus as much on talking about the physical suffering of Jesus as he does simply talking about the fact that they made every effort to shame him. As we look at verse 16, one of the things that, and this is where comparing our translations could get really interesting, we're told at the end of verse 16 that the whole Roman cohort was there. Maybe your translation reads differently because the Greek word there, spira, literally is one-tenth of a legion, which would be a cohort. A legion has about 6,000 soldiers. A cohort has about 600 soldiers. I don't know if there are literally 600 soldiers there in the courtyard of Pilate in the praetorium that day, but we're talking about potentially a significantly sized group of people who are enjoying the spectacle of this moment. They're in the praetorium. And again, depending on what translation you're using, some translations, especially in this verse, are just going to use the word praetorium. The problem is the praetorium is a number of things. It's where Pilate lives. Some translations, when this word gets used in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, will describe this as the governor's palace or the governor's headquarters. Mark even uses that word in verse 16. We're in Mark 15, verse 16, that the soldiers took him away into the palace, that is the praetorium. But it's not just the palace, it's also the place of judgment. It's where Pilate lives and where Pilate works, and likely would be where a garrison of soldiers were also stationed. We know that on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, there was a fortress built that overlooked the whole temple court complex as a way for the Roman soldiers, especially during those big three feast times a year, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, to keep things in order. We know, for example, that when Paul was falsely accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple, that the Romans saw that and rushed in Acts 21. And had they not rushed in, Paul probably would have been killed on that occasion. So the Romans are always keeping a watchful eye on what's happening here. And it could be that this praetorium is associated with the fortress on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount. If you go to Jerusalem today, this isn't a very good picture. They're going to take you on a tour and say this is likely the Praetorium. The problem is this is actually where Solomon kept his horses, Solomon's stables, located near the Temple Mount. We're not exactly sure where the Praetorium was, in part because Herod the Great was a great builder. He had a number of palaces, and even though he's a Jewish leader, Pilate, the Roman procurator, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea from 26 to 36 AD, probably lived and worked in a place Herod built. And so we're not exactly sure where this was, but what we are sure of is that Jesus was taken to a place where a number of Roman soldiers made sport of him, mocked him. And as we continue looking in Mark 15, verses 17 and 18, we see specifically how they made or tried to make a mockery of Jesus. They dressed him up in a purple robe and crowned him with a crown of thorns. Sometimes you'll read where people have speculated that perhaps this was one of the Roman robes, which was reddish in color. But the word used here is the word for the color purple, which we can go and get purple fabric and have purple clothing whenever we want it. I was in a club at Fried Hardeman that had purple, and I wore it so much that they called me Barney. It kind of hurt my feelings. So we can have a lot of access to purple. But in that time, purple was the most expensive dye available, and it was often associated with wealth or royalty. And so Mark specifies that the robe they put on Jesus was purple. Was supposed to make a mockery of the fact that this man who had been condemned to die was allegedly prestigious and powerful. They even saluted him as a sort of parody, trying to mock Jesus in the way that they would salute Caesar or praise the emperor at that time, who was Tiberius, thinking some king he is. And you can just hear again as we look back at Mark 10 and hear what it is that Jesus anticipated would happen. This group of men really having a good time mocking Jesus. Yeah, he's some king. He's about to die. He's powerless. He's in a place we run. They had a lot of fun with this. Now, I was thinking about the possibility that maybe things like this happened in the ancient world more frequently than we're aware of. And while the source I'm about to refer to is not inspired like the Gospel of Mark, I think it illustrates the fact that people made fun of others then, just like, sadly, they do now. There's actually a story that Philo tells. Philo was a Jew who lived in Alexandria, Egypt. He was a contemporary of Jesus, probably born about 20 AD and died in the first century. He, in a letter he writes, tells the story of a man who was likely mentally ill named Carabbas. And he talks about how some of the people made fun of Carabbas by pretending like he was royalty when he was really, according to their estimation, wild, savage, and dangerously mad. We're told, and I've got a couple of slides that tells this story, this man spent all of his days and nights naked in the roads, minding neither the cold nor the heat. Idle children made sport of him. And the story is they drove him, pushed him, as far as the gymnasium, and put him up on a pedestal where everybody could see him. They flattened out a leaf of papyrus and put it on his head instead of a diadem. They clothed the rest of his body with a common doormat instead of a cloak. And instead of a scepter, they put in his hand a small stick of the native papyrus, which they found lying by the wayside. Like actors in theatrical spectacles, he had received the insignia of royal authority, dressed and adorned like a king. The young men took sticks on their shoulders and stood on each side of him instead of spear bearers, an imitation of the bodyguards of the king. And then others came up as if to salute him, others as though they wished to plead their causes before him, others pretending to consult him about the affairs of the day. So we know that people then and now enjoy making fun of others for sport. But I think one of the key differences between what Philo was describing with this unfortunate person who likely was struggling with some kind of illness and Jesus is that the malicious intent of these soldiers was about the fact that they thought Jesus had made claims. Of course, we know Jesus made claims, and they were directly mocking him, not because he deserved it, not because his behavior was like the behavior of the individual that Philo is describing here, but because he was worthy of worship. I mean, that's the irony in the gospel. Here's a man who really is king. He really is Lord. He really is worthy of salutation and praise and royal robes and a crown. And yet, these soldiers ironically don't recognize that. And as we continue reading about the cross, especially in the Gospel of John, Jesus is always in control. Even as he's hanging on the cross in John, his kingship, his attentiveness to the needs of Mary and John, his willingness to forgive, his remembrance of Scripture, citing Psalms on two occasions, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. I mean, here you see one who is as perfect as he claimed to be. And ironically, everyone on the scene except his mother and a few others seem to miss that. And so, as is often the case, what starts as mockery quickly turns into violent behavior. They bow mockingly in homage to him. And then, according to what we read here in verses 19 and 20, specifically at the beginning, or here in verse 19, they beat his head with a staff. Some translations there say reed. This brings back memories of a passage we've already referred to this morning. In Mark 14 and verse 65, you might remember that the Sanhedrin did something similar. They blindfolded Jesus and hit him. And they mockingly asked him to predict or to tell them who hit him. And so he's taken abuse from the Jews before the Sanhedrin in Mark 14. He's taken abuse now at the hands of the Roman soldiers in Mark 15. And he's not surprised by this. He predicted that this would happen, specifically involving both Jews and Gentiles back in Mark 10. And yet everything we're reading about here is just a shadow or a small representation of the agony that will soon follow at the cross, a prelude to the cross. And so you can envision a bloodied and shamed Jesus being led by an execution squad. We believe from extra-biblical literature representing four Roman soldiers and a centurion. A centurion was responsible for 100 soldiers. That's how serious this task was. Then, according to the end of verse 20, leading him out to crucify him. You can't help, as you read these passages, to hear the echo of prophetic passages like Isaiah 50, verse 6. Isaiah 50, verse 6 is clearly messianic, even though modern Jewish interpretation makes this about Israel. In faith, we know it's about Jesus. And Isaiah 50, verse 6 reads, from the first-person perspective, I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I hid not my face from mocking and spitting. So it's not just that Jesus anticipates that these kinds of things were going to happen. The prophets, 800 years earlier, Isaiah the prophet anticipated that this is exactly what Jesus would experience. Now, if you go back and look at the first part of verse 20, it becomes clear that they, Mark again just simply says, they led him away to be crucified. We have referenced the cross and crucifixion so much that I think sometimes we've become desensitized to how horrific and degrading this kind of death would be. This was a type of death reserved for non-Roman citizens. You might remember how in Acts, Paul had been stoned, and he went before the magistrates and mentioned his Roman citizenship, and they quickly there in Philippi begged him to leave town because they recognized that his Roman citizenship protected him from that kind of thing. Well, if Roman citizenship protects you from being stoned, shouldn't Roman citizenship, at least by the Roman authorities, now the Jews don't have any problem stoning anybody who is they accuse of blasphemy, so if you're protected as a Roman citizen from stoning, how much more would you be protected from crucifixion? So what we find historically is that crucifixion was typically reserved for the lowest class individuals, slaves, violent criminals, prisoners of war. We know from ancient records that women from these particular groups were sometimes crucified as well. So with rare exception, at least at this time in history, it seems that Jesus would not have been the typical kind of individual crucified were it not for the pleadings of the Jews at Passover, were it not for the political climate that Pilate found himself in. And there's a lot we could say about his background. The man who put Pilate in office, his name was Aelius Sejanus. He's actually found guilty of treason. And everybody associated with him is suspect. And so when I read about Pilate, I'm seeing a fella that the Jews dislike. Ironically, the sermon this morning is from Luke 13, 1 through 5, and he's mentioned in verse 1 for killing a bunch of Galileans and mixing their blood with their sacrifices. So the Jews dislike Pilate, and the Romans are suspicious of Pilate. So Pilate is in a political quandary. You have the Jews at Passover demanding that Jesus die, and all of these circumstances, of course, I would also credit God's providence here and the promises that he's made in Scripture lead to not only an innocent man, but the kind of person who would never be crucified in most settings being hung on the cross. Why was crucifixion so popular? Well, it was a public spectacle. Usually criminals were crucified by the road so people could see it. And not only was it a public spectacle, but it was a way to deter others from doing whatever that individual either did or was accused of doing. That's why you see the placard above his head. And I think it's ironic that there's no real charge against Jesus. So mockingly, again, you've got that title written in three languages so everybody could read it, right? The King of the Jews, which ironically proclaimed truth. And Pilate wouldn't change it, even when the Jews asked for him to. This would have been a public spectacle. When people walked by and they saw the charge, they would say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to die that way. The cross was supposed to send a message. And when you think about the way that people typically died from crucifixion, it wasn't necessarily blood loss unless an artery had been severed. This was a slow, painful, degrading death. We have records of people hanging on the cross for days on end. One of the reasons why you have the soldiers coming to practice crucifracture and break the legs of these men. Of course, they don't break Jesus' legs, which is also a fulfillment of prophecy. Not a bone of his shall be broken. It's because they wanted to expedite death. And so I think when you look at passages in the New Testament that refer to the shame of the cross, culturally people understood that. You know, and it may be that now we've not only become desensitized to that, but the fact that cross is maybe more common on jewelry than as something that would have been an instrument of death, especially something as shameful as this. Just a few references from the New Testament here. In Hebrews 12, verse 2, right after we read that hall of faith, the writer of Hebrews, in describing Jesus as the one on whom we fix our eyes as we run the race, Hebrews 12, 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Despising the shame of what? The cross. This was supposed to be a way of shaming people. And the irony of the gospel is, Jesus isn't shamed at the cross. He's exalted at the cross. He's honored at the cross. His kingship is made evident at the cross. God uses this in an ironic way. When Paul is describing Jesus, in one of the most beautiful passages about Jesus in all the New Testament, Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11, in Philippians 2, 8, he says, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. There's death, and then there's death on a cross, which is, in that context, about as bad a way as you could go. This is the way they would shame, at least try to shame individuals. And I think for Gentiles, you know, you have Paul the apostle called to be the apostle to the Gentiles. That's mentioned even by Ananias as he's being baptized in Acts 9. In 1 Corinthians 1, verse 23, Paul's talking about preaching Christ. But do you remember what he said there? We preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. Why? How can the hero, how can the Savior of the world, how can the Son of God die? Especially in this way. Well, if we understand what prophecy includes and we understand God's plan, God takes something that the world intended to dishonor Jesus and it honors Jesus. Maybe think about it like this. God takes the most wretched and cruel way suffering, at least humans have ever invented in that world, to make someone suffer and die. And that's where we see Jesus representing us. That's where we see him bearing our sin. And it's interesting how even in antiquity, you have some groups who try to clean up the cross. You have the false teachers, the Gnostics, who even suggest that Simon of Cyrene was the one who died on the cross, which sadly is something that some Muslim apologists still teach. Now, there's an apocryphal legend about Jesus being in the back of the crowd wearing a big jacket, laughing at the fact that Simon is dying rather than him. That's not true. It's Jesus on the cross who breathed his last. And whatever ways that the world has tried to creatively clean that scene up or revision it or make it child appropriate to take away the shame and the gore and the fatigue of the cross misses the fact that God did this for us. He didn't die in his sleep at a ripe old age surrounded by his grandchildren. He didn't die in some convenient way. This was an attempt to make Jesus a spectacle, but ironically, he, in being lifted up, as John 6 says, drew all people to himself. Then we go to verse 21. And we learn, first of all, that this individual named Simon of Cyrene was forced. Maybe you have a translation that reads compelled or constricted. He was forced to take the cross. We're told he was a passerby coming from the country. Now, we know where Cyrene is. Cyrene is a town in North Africa. And so commentaries spend a lot of time talking about his race and perhaps, you know, his skin color or his religious orientation. But here's what we do know about Simon of Cyrene. The same Greek word that's used to describe forcing a slave into service or forcing an animal to do a particular job is used to describe what Simon was forced to do on this particular occasion. Usually the condemned individual here, of course, our innocent Lord, was forced to carry his own crossbeam, in Latin called the patibulum, a heavy crossbeam. And the idea was that after they've been beaten and mistreated, of course we've read about that already this morning, that they would be forced to carry that all the way to the place of execution. And there the upright posts, the stapes, would be awaiting. And so you would latch that crossbeam to the post. It would be lifted up and dropped into a hole. It's difficult to imagine how that would have felt, what that scene would have been like. We know that Jesus is being led there, and there's this Cyrenian. Now, we don't know why he was in town, but I must at least speculate that because it's Passover, it's possible that he was there to celebrate. And we know from Acts 6, verse 9, that there's actually a synagogue in Jerusalem known as the Synagogue of the Freedmen. I don't think that's associated with Fried Hardeman in any way, but the Synagogue of the Freedmen, where we know that Cyrenians, people from Cyrene, are welcome. When this is introduced in Acts, only two groups are named as being associated with this synagogue. And we read that the synagogue of the freedmen included Cyrenians, those from North Africa, and Alexandrians, those from Egypt, Alexandria, Egypt, some from Cilicia and Asia. And they're, of course, on that occasion, arguing with Stephen. So is it possible, I think it is possible, we can't prove it definitively, that Simon was from Cyrene. He's going to the synagogue where Cyrenians are welcome, that's mentioned in Acts 6, verse 9, in Jerusalem, to celebrate the Passover. He's mentioned, interestingly, both in Matthew and Luke, but in those places, we don't learn very much about him. If you go to Matthew 27 and verse 36, all we're told there, much like Mark recalls for us, actually 27 verse 32, as they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, whom they pressed into service to bear Jesus' cross. Luke 23, verse 26, basically says the same thing. This is one of those places where comparing the synoptic gospel accounts isn't very helpful, although there's a different verb used in Luke 23, 26. They seized him, which might be more explicit with regard to the way that Simon was forced to get involved in this. But there is something that Mark mentions here that I find to be very interesting, although I don't really know that we can do much with it. Mark does mention that Simon has two sons, Alexander and Rufus. Alexander would have been a very common name. Rufus is actually associated with the color red. There's been some speculation about, you know, is this kid redheaded? Or, you know, people like to speculate, don't they? But what is a bit fascinating is that in Romans 16, a lot of people don't read Romans 16 because it's filled with 26 names of those that Paul is either greeting in Rome or who are sending greetings from where Paul is writing from in Corinth. But in Romans 16, 13, as Paul, as he is sending greetings to the church in Rome, he says, "Greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord, and his mother, also his mother and mine." And so a lot of people have speculated that the Rufus, that is the son of Simon, here on the day of Jesus' death, is the same Rufus who's in Rome as Paul is sending greetings to the Roman church. That is highly speculative. We can't do anything definitively to demonstrate that. It's one of those things, though, that people have taken and sort of built legends around, connecting Simon with Rome and Peter with Mark and all kinds of other things that result from the fact that Rufus's name shows up in both places. One thing that is interesting, however, when Jesus talks about discipleship, he'll often describe that. For example, in Mark 8, verse 34, here's what he says. Mark 8, 34, he summoned the crowd with his disciples and said, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." Now, it is true that Simon literally did that, but I think the difference is he's forced to do that. And when Jesus talks about discipleship, he, of course, is looking for voluntary discipleship. He's conscripted into service. He did not volunteer to do this. Jesus desires that we respond to God's grace in faith. I wonder, this is again something we can't answer, how Simon's actions that day might have impacted his sons. You know, I love the songs we sing. I'm not a very good song leader. I can't read music, but I sure love the singing at Estes. And I don't know that I've ever heard the song "Watch the Lamb" here, but I wanted to close today by reading the lyrics to you from a song. And the author of this song, Ray Bolts, there's a story there that I won't go into now, but he takes a lot of literary license and tries to tell the story of Simon of Cyrene coming into Jerusalem. He assumes he's coming for the Passover, and he tells the story of the impact that Simon's being compelled into service had on his sons. And again, this is not from Scripture, but it's an interesting song, and I'm not going to show the video this morning, but if you get on YouTube, you might hear this song. There's some great a cappella groups that sing this. But here are the lyrics. Just let's think about this as we conclude our time together. Walking on the road to Jerusalem, the time had come to sacrifice again. This is being told from the perspective of Simon. My two small sons, they walked beside me on the road. The reason they came was to watch the lamb. Daddy, daddy, what will we see there? There's so much that we don't understand. So I told them of Moses and Father Abraham. Then I said, dear children, watch the lamb. There will be so many in Jerusalem today, we must be sure the lamb doesn't run away. And I told them of Moses and Father Abraham, and I said, dear children, watch the lamb. When we reached the city, I knew something must be wrong. There were no joyful worshipers, no joyful worship songs. I stood there with my children in the midst of angry men. Then I heard the crowd cry out, crucify him. We tried to leave the city, but we could not get away. Forced to play in this drama, a part I did not wish to play. Why upon this day were men condemned to die? Why were we standing here, where soon they would pass by? I looked and said, even now they come. The first one cried for mercy. The people gave him none. The second one was violent. He was arrogant and loud. I can still hear his angry voice screaming at the crowd. Then someone said, "There's Jesus." I could scarce believe my eyes. A man so badly beaten, he barely looked alive. Blood poured from his body, from the thorns upon his brow, running down the cross, falling to the ground. I watched him as he struggled. I watched him as he fell. The cross came down upon his back, and the crowd began to yell. In that moment, I felt such agony. I felt such loss, till a Roman soldier grabbed my arm and screamed, "You take the cross." At first, I tried to resist him. Then he reached his hand for his sword. So I knelt and took the cross from the Lord. I placed it on my shoulder and started down the street. The blood that he'd been shedding was now running down my cheek. They led us to Golgotha. They drove nails deep in his feet and hands. Yet upon the cross, I heard him pray, "Father, forgive them. Oh, never have I seen such love in any other eyes. Into thy hands I commit my spirit," he prayed, and there he died. I stood for what seemed like years. I lost all sense of time until I felt two tiny hands holding tight to mine. My children stood there weeping. I heard the oldest say, "Father, please forgive us. The lamb ran away. Daddy, Daddy, what have we seen here? There's so much that we don't understand." So I took them in my arms, and we turned and faced the cross. And I said, "Dear children, watch the lamb." I don't know what Simon's story ended up being, but I just can't help but think that everybody who witnessed these events, and even now, we who through the eyes of faith read this text and think about what it is that Jesus experienced for us, how much we have to be thankful for. There are a lot of people in our world who need to know about Jesus, and it may be, for whatever reason, that certain seasons people think more about Jesus than other seasons, but I would encourage each one of us to never forget the power of the sacrifice that Jesus made and the nature of his suffering and how, despite all the things he suffered here, he was honored. And he offers us honor, ironically, through taking up our cross and sacrificing our will for his will. I know that next week we'll look forward to picking up in verse 21 or 22 of Mark 15. It's just been a pleasure to be able to be with y'all this morning. Looking forward to a great day of worship and study together.